The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics says the inflation rate is dropping. When will consumers see a decrease in prices? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. I'm Lucy May. We're going to spend the hour talking about inflation, sure to be a topic in the upcoming presidential debate between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump. Joining me now to get us started are University of Cincinnati Associate Professor of Political Science, David Niven. Welcome back, David.
Always a pleasure, Lucy.
Always great to have you here. And Miami University Associate Professor of Economics, Nam Vu. Thanks for being here, Nam.
Thank you for having me, Lucy.
UC and Miami University are financial supporters of Cincinnati Public Radio. Inflation has reached its lowest level in more than 3 years, but food prices are 21% above where they were 3 years ago. David, with the presidential debate tomorrow night, what message are we going to be hearing from the candidates when it comes to inflation?
Well, there's two things, you know, to acknowledge here. One is the numbers, the stats themselves, which say things are getting better and that, you know, buying power for Americans is actually up when you factor in both the cost of things and wages and the low unemployment rate. But then there's the way people feel about all these things, and they feel badly about them. And one of the things that political science research is actually pretty good at is figuring out the difference between what's actually happening and what people feel about it. And the bottom line is, how we feel about the economy is in many ways unrelated to how it is. So to get to the direct answer, they're going to talk about people's pain and they're going to talk about a path forward, even as things are already getting better.
And Nam, I just mentioned that figure about food prices, that they're 21% above where they were 3 years ago, despite inflation being down. What's going on here? Why are food prices still so much higher?
Thank you, Lucy. This is very interesting number here indeed. So part of the problem is that a lot of the articles that we see in the news typically cite inflation using an inflation number that we call core inflation. Now, what it means is that this inflation number does not include things like the price of food and energy. So effectively, when you hear inflation of 3% in the news, chances are that such a number may not include the change in the price of the grocery that you pick up at the store. So that leads to a discrepancy between what you perceive and what you actually hear in the news. And in addition, we also observe a huge increase in consumer sensitivity, especially arising from COVID areas that is still a remnant that kind of build into expectation going forward. So on the one hand, we see a discrepancy from the official data. On the other hand, you will see consumer being more sensitive, which actually amplify this perceived difference between those two numbers.
I see. And Nam, one big news story last week was that a Kroger executive testified that the company had raised milk and egg prices beyond inflation. And that testimony came amid a legal battle over the Kroger-Albertsons merger. Tell us a little bit about this testimony and what it said to you.
So this is a very sensitive time for, especially for grocery price, given that a lot of American families are under pressure when it's come to groceries. And to kind of alleviate some of the concern with respect to inflation, like you mentioned, 21%, Kroger CEOs and to some extent Albertson also proposed that they are going to use some of the funding with a promise to reduce the price of products. In the testimony, one of the problem was that is that in the past, those promises, about one third of the promises are not honored. This is by some study by the FTC back in 2012. And because they may not be honest, the chance of, you know, actual decrease in food prices might not be a guarantee based on that proposal. Another problem is that if we look at the landscape for the market for the top four largest grocery retailer Walmart, Kroger, Costco, and Albertsons, the share of those actually grew by around 40%, anywhere from 35 to 45% in the past 3 decades. So this actually can be a problem because further increase in market power can turn out to be extremely costly to consumer. And in the landscape of high inflation or high perceived inflation, that can be a big problem.
And I know Kroger said in its defense, a Kroger spokesperson sent a statement to Business Insider about that. And the statement said, "This cherry-picked email covers a specific period and does not reflect Kroger's decades-long business model to lower prices for customers by reducing its margins," referring to an email that was part of this federal case related to the Kroger and Albertsons merger. David, Vice President Harris has been campaigning on a promise to crack down on grocery inflation.
"As president, I will take on the high costs that matter most to most Americans, like the cost of food."
Do you expect that her plan will come up in the debate tomorrow, David? And can you tell us any more about what her plan entails?
Well, just to step back for a moment, that Kroger spokesperson assuring us all that they're working on lowering prices, of course, was not under oath when they made that statement. And I think, it is telling the bottom line. Kroger's profits were up 5% at the end of this most recent reporting year, and it was up 5% the year before. And, the bottom line here is this has all been working out really, really well for grocery retailers. And as Nam alluded to, part of that is just the consolidation, that there are fewer of them controlling more of the market. But for Harris, she has to be looking to say how we're going to make some change. She has to be looking to how we can present this as, in touch with what the average American is experiencing. So, what the Biden-Harris administration has done, I think, successfully is go after certain pain points like the cost of prescription drugs, go after certain pain points like corporate practices that make it hard for people to be treated fairly, like companies that won't let you cancel a subscription. So I would expect ultimately we're going to get ideas along those lines of going after the practices that are most infuriating, and certainly going after consolidation in the marketplace and attacking things like this Kroger merger that would just result in fewer choices for American consumers.
We're talking about what the presidential candidates say they're going to do about inflation and why prices remain high when the inflation rate is decreasing. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Nam, the way Vice President Harris has characterized her plan when it comes to grocery prices is as a crackdown on what her campaign has termed price gouging. I understand that plan has received some criticism from economists. Are there holes in this idea? Could it be problematic to force prices to be lowered?
Well, as with any policy that tried to force price to go down single-handedly, it can be very tricky, especially policy that effectively limit prices for certain products. To implement those, of course, the issue is the details, because at the end of the day, we need to know how much it actually costs the taxpayer. In the past two administration, we have various policy that cost multiple trillions of dollars, and it can be problematic if this plan costs a lot. And my suspicion is that it will cost a lot. So it will be very difficult to see whether it is something feasible without knowing the actual detail of her proposal.
Well, and we talk a lot about inflation, but there's also deflation. As an economist, Nam, can you explain what deflation is, and does that present risks for the economy as a whole?
Absolutely. So inflation essentially captures the extent to which the cost of a typical consumption basket increase from one period to another. And Deflation is a phenomenon that happens when we have negative inflation, which is when price decrease. Now we rarely see deflation. The only couple of periods that we truly see deflation was in the 1930s and more recently, one quarters during the 2008 recession. But for the most part, what I think is more, I guess, more delightful to see here is that we actually see in this inflation, which is essentially the extent to which inflation has been subsiding in the past couple of years. So this inflation is actually something that we rarely hear about, but it's even more important to notice that is a decrease in the rate of inflation. So right now, I don't think that we have much of a concern with respect to deflation, because the current inflation rate is around 2.9 to 3%, I think the last quarter, which is still above the historical target of the Federal Reserve of 2%. So I think we still have a long, long way there.
Okay, we do have a caller on the line. Hi, Art. Thanks for your call. What's your question or comment? Are you with us, Art? Okay, we're having some technical difficulties with Art. I'm going to put you back on hold. We'll try to figure that out. We think Art's there and has some questions. David, we are preparing for this debate tomorrow, the first big presidential debate between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Trump. Who do you think Americans are more likely to trust when it comes to the economy, David? What are polls showing in that regard?
The bottom line of polls is it's almost perfectly split. And I think one of the underlying themes of this whole discussion has to be how much our view of the economy has become partisan. You know, whether you think this is a glass half full economy or glass half empty has high, high relationship to your overall partisan outlook. And so, you know, for most folks, you really can't separate out the candidate, the party, and their view of the economic path forward. And one of the sort of side points here, of course, is both candidates are going to present themselves as a mechanism for change. And, you know, Trump obviously has going for him that he's not presently in office. Harris has going for her, of course, you know, the sea change in this election by replacing the president on the ballot. You know, obviously she can offer a vision for the next 4 years that doesn't have to hew as closely to what President Biden has been doing for the last 4 years.
Well, we are going to continue our conversation after a short break. And later in the program, we'll get tips for budgeting to stretch our dollars. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about inflation this hour, the presidential candidates' economic plans, and the impact each strategy could have on the economy overall. My guests are University of Cincinnati Associate Professor of Political Science, David Niven, and Miami University Associate Professor of Economics, Nam Vu. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at WVXU.org. I think we have Art back. Hi, Art. Are you with us?
Hi there.
Hey, yes, there. Sorry we lost you last time. What was your question or comment?
I wanted to address the mathematical disconnect that seems to be there. At the top of the hour, you asked the questions, how is inflation coming down and groceries are still 20% more expensive? And the reason, and politicians lie about this all the time, is inflation is only a measure of how quickly our price is going up. So inflation coming down just means, excuse me a second. Inflation going down just means that prices aren't going up as quickly. It doesn't speak to them coming down unless you actually get deflation. So yeah, Biden's up there saying inflation is down, but that still means prices are going up, just not as quickly.
Okay. Well, thanks, Art. I appreciate that. Nam, is there anything you'd like to add to that? A consumer who is not an economist, I can speak for myself that when you see inflation's coming down, you'd like to see your grocery bill go down a little bit. Is that unreasonable for people to expect, Nam?
Well, certainly. So the economy at every moment in time, we will have some growth within the economy. So it's normal to expect some inflation, some change in price level. typically, this is usually around maybe 1 to 2%, depending on the areas. But Art is absolutely right that that is a measure of a change in price level. So it's not necessarily a decrease in price level like we would like to see.
Okay. Thanks so much for that call, Art. We sure appreciate it. And thanks for sticking with us through our technical problems. Nam, I want to move beyond grocery inflation. The candidates have other plans for the economy. Vice President Harris has discussed an expanded child tax credit.
So as president, I'll not only restore that tax cut, but expand it. We will provide $6,000 in tax relief to families during the first year of a child's life.
And when former President Trump was asked about child care, he talked about tariffs.
And my daughter Ivanka was so impactful on that issue. It's a very important issue. But I think when you talk about the kind of numbers that I'm talking about, that because look, child care is child care. It's couldn't, you know, there's something you have to have it. In this country, you have to have it. But when you talk about those numbers compared to the kind of numbers that I'm talking about by taxing foreign nations at levels that they're not used to, but they'll get used to it very quickly. And it's not going to stop them from doing business with us, but they'll have a very substantial tax when they send product into our country. Those numbers are so much bigger than any numbers that we're talking about, including childcare, that it's going to take care. We're going to have, I look forward to having no deficits within a fairly short period of time.
Nam, some experts have argued that both candidates could actually trigger renewed price increases, so more inflation. What do you think?
First of all, I do agree that neither candidate actually proposed a plan that I think would effectively lead to a reduction in inflation. On the one hand, we saw the potential additional spending in terms of child care tax credit. And if anything's the program can be very, very costly. And if the number is right, $6,000, it is a non-trivial number. And it's once again, without the detail, it is be very difficult to fully assess the veracities of such a plan. However, you know, with the spending, it is likely that it will lead to potential increase in price level. And on the other hand, if we look at the policy by Donald Trump, the presidential candidate, then if we look at the previous Tax Cuts and Job Act of 2017, which he actually proposed to make it more permanent basis, that program actually was quite expensive as well. And the extent to which it can combat inflation is rather unclear without all the details. So I suspect that it's really difficult to see how this proposal, unless we see all of the details being presented, to have a complete cost and benefit analysis.
Yeah, well, thank you. David, our last caller, Art, he, you know, pointed out this difference between inflation and prices, which was very helpful. But he also made some comment about how politicians lie. I guess I wonder how much control do presidents have over inflation? How much or how little? Is this something that's, you know, I know certainly presidents get blamed for inflation or get credit for when inflation isn't bad, but how much control do they really have?
They have very, very little control. And you know, this is one of those things where, you know, president, as you said, is going to get credit when things are good that they had nothing to do with making good, and blame when things are bad that they had nothing to do with making bad. Inflation in recent years has been a worldwide phenomenon, and in fact was much higher in Europe than in the United States. And you know, our economy, of course, is tied into the economies of the world, tied into the economies of our trading partners. So you know, the problem for presidents is this is something people can see, they can grasp, they can feel it. And so much of what you accomplish, you know, isn't in people's lives on a daily basis, but the price of groceries is in their lives on a daily basis. So that, you know, that's the challenge for presidents. And ironically, even though this is all about math, ultimately the win you get here is about creating a feeling that things are getting better, creating a feeling that you're doing something. And that's the challenge for Harris to present in the debate. And that's the challenge for Trump to present in the debate.
David, you know, Nam was just talking about these two different plans that the candidates have presented and how it would be, you know, helpful to have more details. But even based on what we know about the plans so far, how did the two candidates differ politically in terms of the constituents they're aiming these policies at?
Well, that is part of the challenge, of course. They're really, for the most part, talking to two very, very different worlds and with very, very different perceptions of what's going on. And, you know, the irony of American politics, as we're so deeply and profoundly divided, is despite that fact, this election will come down to the handful of swing voters in the handful of swing states. And, you know, what are they experiencing in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, Nevada, North Carolina, and Georgia? That's the bottom line. And so, you know, for Vice President Harris, she has to be responsive to the concerns they have, even if things are getting a little bit better. And for Trump, of course, this is in his wheelhouse to exaggerate, you know, to bring out the hyperbole and make this out to be the biggest problem going. But here's the one thing that matters. A decent chunk of Americans do see the economy as the biggest problem. So it's going to be a part of the conversation, whether it's helpful to the candidates or not.
Nam, you know, David was just saying the president doesn't have a lot of control or really any control much over inflation, whether it's good or bad. But the federal government has pumped a lot of money into the economy through spending and tax cuts over the years. What impact has that had on inflation and prices?
So this is, I think this is a rather tricky question to answer. Part of it has to do with the extent to which a lot of those, what we call open market operation from the Federal Reserve, was trying to dampen a lot of the demand side pressure on price level. And in theories, the action of the Federal Reserve are supposed to be independent of the federal government. And on the other hand, we also see that the federal government had been running a deficit for as long as we remember, right? So this is a tricky part when you have the one arms of the federal government acting in one direction and potentially the others was running in a slightly different target. So it is tricky to fully assess the extent to which the combined effect of those two on the economy.
We got an email from Shannon. Shannon writes, consumers do pay an increased cost of items due to tariffs. Tariffs also hurt U.S. exporters like farmers. Is that pretty clear, Nam, that tariffs end up funneling higher costs to consumers and hurt farmers?
Absolutely. So actually, if historical evidence is anything, if we look at the 1930s, when we have the Spoot and Harvey's Tariff Act, which essentially was, have a dampening effect on the whole economy. And if we look at the potential additional tariff during the 2018 period, there actually evidence a potential pass-through in terms of such a tariff on an overall price level. That said, you know, the proposed tariff, the extent to which it impact price level, is rather unclear if we just simply look at the current proposal as it is.
David, you were talking about what the candidates are likely to try to tap into during tomorrow's presidential debate. Do you think people will be watching how the candidates talk about inflation during the debate tomorrow? Do you think that's going to be one of those things that people are really keyed into?
Well, I think it's one of those things that it's easy to talk about and hard to really, you know, move people on. And so, you know, what's most likely to come away from this debate is a feeling about how the the candidates responded to each other. I think what's most likely to strike people is how different the give and take will be amongst these two candidates than what we've seen before. But certainly what candidates do in a debate is they have to avoid harming themselves. And so for Harris, she has to appear engaged in this and prepared to, in effect, build on what the current administration has done. And for Trump, obviously, this is, along with immigration, this is the kind of thing he's going to talk about relentlessly as a means of attacking the administration.
Well, I've been talking with University of Cincinnati Associate Professor of Political Science, David Niven. Thanks so much for your time today, David.
Thank you, Lucy.
Miami University Associate Professor of Economics, Nam Vu, is going to stick around for the next part of our program when we talk about strategies to budget during times of inflation. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We just heard that the rate of inflation is dropping in the U.S., but our average grocery bill remains significantly higher than it was before the COVID-19 pandemic. So let's talk about tips for trimming our monthly expenses. Miami University Associate Professor of Economics, Nam Vu, is still with us from the first part of the program. Thanks for sticking around, Nam.
My pleasure, Lucy.
And joining us now is Northern Kentucky University Hale College of Business economist Janet Hara. Thanks for being here, Janet.
Hi, Lucy.
Miami University is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Nam, as we talked about earlier, food prices are still significantly higher than they were before the pandemic, especially when it comes to meat. What are some of the factors contributing to those higher prices?
So there's actually a number of factors that have been actively contributing to such high prices. One of the things that we have observed is a relatively tight labor market. Then some of the sector, we actually observe very high increase in pandemic era wages. And this trend overall can actually induce significant increase in price level. And one sector that really stand out also during pandemic is healthcare sector, and in general, more recently, service sector in general. And that can actually lead to increases in the products that we see at grocery store because everybody needs services, whether it's distribution, retail, or other type of services. And on top of that, we also have various shocks to the economy arising from supply chain, which is not fully resolved. We also have potential uncertainty with respect to the election and what's going on with monetary policy that lead to firm may preemptively increase the price in some cases. And that all of those factors can actually put an upward pressure on the overall price level that we observe in our everyday life.
Well, I imagine if you add something like avian flu to the mix, that can just stress things even additionally, couldn't it, Nam?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. The U.S. Department of Agriculture recommends food plans at various cost levels for families, ranging from thrifty to liberal spending plans. As of March, the USDA recommends a family of four on a thrifty budget spend $976.60 per month. This is for food costs. A family of on a liberal budget is recommended to spend $1,585.20 per month. Nam, I'll start with you. I want to get your thoughts on this too, though, Janet. How realistic is that thrifty budget of just about $976 a month for a family of four to spend on food? I'm not sure if you heard that, Nam. Do you
yes.
think that's
it? Oh,
that's okay.
Absolutely, yeah. To be honest, I really think is that number really depend on where you are located. So it's difficult to say at the federal level that that number is something that is sustainable. If we think about location with high costs, with relatively high minimum wages, like California's, I don't think that number would make sense. However, if you move forward to other location that have cheaper cost of living, my suspicion is that those number would be more appropriate for those region.
Janet, what do you think?
So I think it's important to realize, you know, the $950 roughly that you're getting every month for a family of four living in Cincinnati metro area, that's more than enough money to feed your family. But most SNAP beneficiaries are getting more along the lines of $300 and $350 a month. They're expected to pay for part of their own groceries. So most people are not getting anywhere near that $950 benefit.
I see. And that's the kind of maximum a family of four could get under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program or SNAP benefits. That's what you're saying. And most people don't get that.
Correct.
Okay. We're talking about tips for trimming our monthly expenses. Do you have questions or tips you'd like to share? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Janet, I know several years ago you spent a year trying to grocery shop, spending the same amount that a family of four would be able to receive in those SNAP benefits. Why did you do that?
At the time, it was very trendy among the celebrities in Hollywood to say, I'm going to live on a SNAP, you know, on the food stamps for a day or a week. I'm like, well, that's not how most people shop. You know, you don't buy flour and eat it all in 1 week. So I wanted to see, like, if you did it for an extended period of time, what did that look like? Like I said, if you get the full $950 benefit, it's probably doable for most people unless you have really specialized dietary needs. But when you're talking about giving a family that's already a low income $300 to feed a family of four, that is very, very challenging.
So it sounds like one of the big lessons is, hey, with that full amount, you could make it work, but with a fraction of it, it's really tough. Where did you see the most cost savings when you were trying to save for your own family?
I think the big thing is you have to be willing to cook at home. And you have to be willing to cook more from scratch and less with convenience food. You're paying for that convenience food. You're paying for someone else to make it and package it and send it to your home. So you have to be willing to do more of the work yourself.
How much can coupons help? Are you a coupon clipper, Janet?
I am a coupon clipper. The paper coupons are kind of being phased out. Now where you're finding your coupons is at your store's loyalty card. So they're mostly online with the loyalty card from whatever grocery stores you shop at. But they are there.
Yeah. Now, what about you? Are there particular ways that you look to spend money, or I should rather save money, in your own personal budget?
So I find that Costco or certain discounted store can provide really good bang for the buck. Personally, that's where I'd like to see, because I have a family of four. Just exactly like in the example, and the number seems to that you mentioned seems to be in line with what we see in our grocery bill.
And Costco, like Sam's, those are our membership stores, as I understand it. You have to pay something to be able to shop there, right?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. I know that can be tricky for some, you know, lower income people who maybe don't have that flexibility in their budgets to buy those memberships. Janet, were there, you know, you talked about how if you got the full amount that SNAP affords, that roughly $950, you could feed a family of four on that. But you mentioned in some discussions about this at the time that there were also some advantages that you had that maybe a low-income family doesn't, that could make that budget more workable. Can you talk to us about those?
Yes, the most important one is I do not live in a food desert. I've got half a dozen grocery stores within a 2-mile radius of my home. That's not true for a lot of people. They might only have one store. It may be a high-cost store, not a low-cost store. So that's one. I think the other is I do know how to cook. I've been cooking since I was a little kid, so I know how to cook. And I know how to meal plan. And I also think it's really important for low-income families who are working multiple jobs to keep life going. The time needed to cook can become a barrier for families. Cooking from scratch does take more time.
Yeah, you're paying one way or the other, either for the convenience or for the time that you spend, I guess. And not everyone can afford to buy in bulk, even if you, you know, somebody gave you a Costco membership as a gift. You have to spend to get your 26 toilet paper rolls or whatever it is. Even not everyone can afford to buy larger sizes of products that are less expensive by the ounce or the pound. Janet, are there some alternatives to that if you can't afford to buy in bulk or buy those bigger sizes of the products you need?
I always tell people the best savings tool you have is your groceries ads every Wednesday. That's, they're going to have loss leaders on the front of the page. That's when you stock up. You don't, because most of us, like you said, if you're low income, you don't have the money to go in and buy the 48 toilet paper rolls at one time. But if, you know, Kroger, for example, is having peanut butter at 99 cents a jar this week, you go in and you buy five of them. So that's what I always tell people, start with the ads. Every grocery store has loss leaders every week. You start there.
Hmm. Nam, are there approaches that can work better when budgeting for an individual versus a family? Because I, you know, when you're an individual, you don't necessarily want to buy huge quantities of things either, if especially things that could spoil.
So I think the bundle, you're absolutely right. For individual, it can be very tricky to buy in bulk. Especially a lot of products can go bad really, really quickly. However, there's actually alternative to the standard store that we usually see, like Kroger or Walmart. One is that I can think of is Aldi, in which they follow a scheme in which they have relatively small selection, but that come at a potentially lower cost, and those costs are passed on to consumer. And this is something that I noticed from their store as well, that they have relatively affordable price for certain products, and relative to Kroger's, relative to even Walmart. So I think that would be a good place to consider.
Mm-hmm. Janet, what do you think? Are there things that you would recommend in addition to that if you're an individual and you're looking to save, you know, on your grocery bill?
Yes, I think also, Nam said, it's very important to figure out which grocery stores are giving you the best value for you for what you want to buy. If you're, like in my case, if you're an empty nester, I don't need 48 rolls of toilet paper. I'm not going to shop at Costco or at Sam's Club, but I might go and wait until toilet paper's on sale somewhere and get a couple of small rolls or small packages for our household. So I think, you know, there's just a variety of things that you can do, but I think look for sales, use coupons. And one of the reasons that Aldi is inexpensive is because they have their own store brands. If you want to get the best price, you usually buy the store brand.
I want to ask you about this too, whether you're familiar with this 50-30-20 budgeting rule and how some are suggesting to modify it to 60-30-10 during times of inflation. Janet, talk to us about that.
The idea is you spend 50% on necessities, 30% on, you know, non-essentials, and then you take 20% and save it for long, either short or long-term savings. I always think of if it's an era of inflation, having a little extra padding in your emergency fund is probably not a bad idea. Whether that should be, you know, what that exact percentage is, I don't know. I think the main thing is to make sure you have as much as possible, try to have at least a month worth of expenses in case you were to lose a job or get ill or have some other event happen that would prevent you from working.
Kind of that emergency savings fund that you have to cushion your blow if you lose your job or can't work for some reason.
Yes.
Yeah. Nam, what do you think? Do you advise people that even when prices are high at the grocery store, it's still really important to save?
Absolutely. I think especially during period when we have relatively high interest rate relative compared to the past 15 years, perhaps, you know, saving a little bit would be very beneficial. And also more importantly, during period when the stock market is not very high, relatively speaking, occasionally you have discount, right? Sometime in October, you have period that the stock market went down significantly. Perhaps it'll be good if we can you know, budget some of that, put more of that money toward the saving during that period. Because at the end of the day, we think about saving via vehicle like stock or mutual fund or any index fund as products, right? And if you know, if you have to keep 50%, 60% as what you really, really need, but then be a little bit more flexible for the rest, perhaps during months that the stock market turn out to be good deals, and perhaps, you know, going to during those, and then, you know, when it's not so high, you know, you can smooth out your consumption that way. So point is, but what I'm trying to say is that saving is still very important, and the extent to which we have those budgeting rules really depend on the state of the market and potentially your other need as well.
Janet, what about reducing rates on other debts? I'm thinking things like credit card debts. Should people consider these 0% APR balance transfers or even personal loans to reduce the interest rates they might be paying on their credit cards?
So I think it's really important to balance servicing your debt and having at least a modest savings account for emergencies. I would start with having an emergency account, even if it's only a modest one, you know, $1,000 to $1,500. So if your car, you know, if your tire blows, you can get to work. You can buy a new tire and get to work. If the dryer goes out, you can buy a new dryer and get, you know, wash your clothes. So I would start with having that savings account. When it comes to paying off your debt, there's kind of two ways of thinking about it. You do it mathematically, if you're going to do it the right way, you would say, I'm going to start with the highest interest rate and pay those off first. But most of the psychology around paying off debt is more like start with your little debts and pay them off first and start building momentum. Either way will work. Either way will get you where you need to be. So it's kind of like which one works better for you as an individual. But I also think it's really important to analyze what is a necessity and what is not. So most people would say, yes, we need transportation. We need a car to get to work. But do you need a $75,000 truck with a $700 or $800 a month payment to go to work? So that's the other thing is too, is deciding what's an essential and what's a luxury, and, you know, spend less on the luxuries and more on the necessities.
Nam, what should people consider if they're thinking about, oh my gosh, I have all this credit card debt. They've got these really high interest rates. I want to figure out a way to get out from under that. What are some of the factors people should think about before deciding whether to try to get a personal loan from their bank, for example?
I think that whether they should get a personal loan really depend on their financial situation. But given that a lot of the interest rate on the personal loan is lower than the typical interest rate for credit card, I think mathematically it doesn't make a lot of sense to take care of very high loan, very high interest rate loan with lower interest rate loan coming from your personal loan. So I totally agree with Janet in the sense that we will need to, I think most consumers should take care of very high interest rate debt first, and whether it's by, you know, taking on potentially personal loan to do that, is really up to them. Yes.
Yeah.
So Lucy, one caution I always give people too is like, if you want to try to pay off debt or consolidate your loans, whatever that case may be, don't use your house as your collateral. If you do get into financial trouble, you want to be able to stay in your house. So I always tell people, if you can't get a personal loan without the collateral of your house, I wouldn't do it.
Sounds like good advice. Janet, how about things like you talked about understanding what is truly essential and what is something you can live without? How much can people save by even changing car insurance companies or eliminating some of those subscription services they might have for those streaming services and things?
So I did this exercise yesterday in anticipation of today. I listed out 20 types of canned goods, tomatoes, beans, green beans, etc. And I priced them at three different grocery stores here in town. And the price differential, none of them were on sale. It was just regular price. the price differential between the lowest and the highest was almost 30%. So yes, you can make progress by figuring out what's the best place to shop.
Wow. How much time did that take, though? I guess I'm wondering, especially for people who are scrambling with little kids and juggling multiple jobs, and it seems like figuring that out takes some time and some mental energy, doesn't it?
It definitely takes some mental energy, but today all the stores have their prices online. So it took me about 20 minutes just sitting down with the computer, and I called up the websites of those three stores and just started plugging in what I wanted and get the price. But I think the point there is just to do as an exercise to say, could I save a significant amount of money? Whether it's your car, your food, clothing, where you buy it, and what you buy really impacts the bottom line.
And Nam, you referred to this a little bit earlier. I saw one tip in preparing for this, that even when you're trying to trim costs, you should make sure to make some room in your budget to invest.
Yes.
I wonder what you think about that and how realistic that is for people who are really, you know, struggling to live paycheck to paycheck.
So I think, first of all, especially if you still have debt, especially high interest debt, that need to be taken care of first. Mm-hmm. Especially credit card debt to the tune of 20%. The reality is that no matter how, chances are that you cannot get 20% on the stock market or with CD or any other financial vehicle. But that's why, you know, getting rid of those debt is more important, is the first order important. Now, once you have cleared some of those debt by either method that Jenna suggests, perhaps that's where we should prioritize investing for the futures.
Okay.
So Nama, I'm curious, what do you think of though about the person that works someplace where their employer is matching a 401k? I always would suggest that they at least save enough to get the full match from their employer.
Okay, don't leave money on the table. Well, I've been talking with Miami University Associate Professor of Economics, Nam Vu, and Northern Kentucky University Hale College of Business Economist, Janet Hara. Thank you both so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. And Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.